Again, this is relatively open, so if you have any questions at any time, feel free to stop me and ask. Also with this, I've sort of mixed a bit of the user side and sysadmin side, like how do we actually use these, as well as a bit of the technical side, so what the internals of the engines are actually using, to give you some idea of why there's differences here and how they work. First thing, indexes, they're quite useful in a number of different places, databases being one of the main ones that we're looking at, but there's a number of different types, and we'll go through some of these different types and how they work. They're predominantly used for improving the read or search speed within the database, but they do increase the workload in terms of updates, deletes, and inserts. So you have to try and get that delicate balance there sometimes. A lot of people aren't aware that indexes don't work in all situations. Quite often we see people using syntax like these ones, where they look for a substring and they'll do that using a like statement enclosed with wildcards. Essentially doing that basically nullifies the index. You can't use it. So as soon as you have a wildcard with a like at the front, it basically means it can't use that index.
Jonathan, this is a key thing for me, some of the work I do, and I run into databases that reverse
yes.
the data and their indexes. Ah.
Which is the next one, although I think I've actually got this in reverse order by mistake. But essentially the principle's the same. So what you do is you can actually reverse that string and do your query in pretty much the same way, just using the reverse function, which will then allow you to use that. Obviously, if you're doing lots of substring searches, you might be better off looking at a full text index anyway, depending upon what you're using.
Yep.
But we'll look at that shortly as well. A couple of other things, composite indexes. A lot of people, what they do, they start out by adding an index to a particular column to help with a query. They find that their performance suddenly improves quite dramatically, so they start adding indexes onto all the columns or onto a larger number of columns. And depending on how big their database is, that may or may not work for them, but it's not optimal. Composite indexes are designed to allow you to create an index across multiple columns. So you have one to read from, you have one to update, one to insert, so the workload's less in that case. So this is generally the structure. You can have multiple columns defined. The issue is that, again, we can only work from left to right in using it. So when we create this top one here, ID, country, region and city, we can only do queries based on these combinations. We can't, for example, use country and city because it's actually in the middle of our composite index. And that's simple to see why that is once we start looking at the structure, which is a B-tree, and how they work. Covering indexes, this one a lot of people don't know about. Essentially, what it means is that all the data that we're querying will come out of the index itself. So potentially there's two steps. You access the index to do the search, find out what the record is, and then quite often you'll go to disk to retrieve that record, or if you're lucky, to a buffer to retrieve that record as the second step. With a covering index, essentially every field that you mention, in this case ID, region and country, will be in that one index. And so you're able to retrieve that data directly from the index in that case. So this is a lot faster because generally your indexes will be in memory anyway, and that way you don't have that extra step and no disk IO related to that as well. Anyone not know about covering indexes? Everyone's aware of them? Yeah, a few people. Just quickly, a couple of other areas that indexes can cause problems. Order bys. We see situations where we get order by A.name, B.city, so you're ordering across two different tables. Essentially, no indexing is going to help there because they work separately. But with some of the newer technologies coming out, index merging is one which we'll talk about later, and bitmap indexes, they may help there. The group by has similar problems. Again, if we try and group by columns across different tables, which some people do when you get very large complex queries, you essentially, again, basically take out the option of an index. You can't create a composite index across tables. So what's the option here? Well, essentially, you could look at taking out some of the grouping and order bys and doing that in the application side, or you essentially have to try and increase your buffer size to account for the group bys and joins that you're going to have there. So looking at some of the structural side of indexes and how they work in MySQL, I've got the structure of a B plus tree here. The B tree structure most people would be familiar with if they do any sort of programming. With MySQL, most of the engines use some form of B tree or variation thereof. So the B plus tree is a good example of how they relate. The B tree is almost identical to this structure, except it stores data in the internal nodes as well. So the B tree has data all at this bottom level, what they call the leaf nodes, whereas the B tree can store it in the higher nodes as well. The other advantage with the B plus tree structure is that we have a linked list, usually along the bottom here. Why might that be useful? Across the bottom there.
Recovery archiving.
Yeah. Yeah, basically, if you're doing sequential access, it's an ordered list, essentially, through there. So rather than traversing through the tree, you can just go straight through the linked list to get that range. All leaf nodes in the B trees are at the same level. This means that the smaller we can keep this B tree, the less number of branches we have, the faster it'll be, and obviously the less space it'll take up in memory. It's easier to manage. However, there are some downsides, and that is their balancing tree. So when you get to a stage where the nodes become full, they actually have to rotate in certain ways, and the worst case is if we have to rebalance the whole tree. But a lot of the alternative structures of B trees have ways of managing that in a lot of ways to take out that possibility. What are the pros of the B tree? It offers very fast searches, and also in terms of ordering, because of that linked list. It's used in pretty much all databases, as well as many other areas. It's good for range searches. So if we have a query where where column between 1 and 10, or where date is greater than this and less than that, it's very good for that, because essentially we go to a subtree and we just return that subtree set. What are the disadvantages? Sometimes in doing that, we do have to go through the whole tree to get to the one that we want. And we do have a higher overload when we have high writes. So if we have a lot of writes, the index will take some performance hit in updating that. Most storage engines support B-tree in one way or another. NODB uses the B plus tree. It also has a secondary hash index as well that works with that. Another structure that's used is a hash index. Essentially, what that does, it takes the key, puts it through a transformation, and that will then match to your record pointer or value, however it's done. So in this case, we see certain names go to map to an actual index number, which has a pointer to the records. It's very simple to implement. Its functionality is quite simple on how it works, and it's very fast in doing equality lookups. So if we want to say find Joe Smith, it can go immediately to that record. It doesn't have to traverse a tree. Where it does fall out is in range searches. So if we want to do something like, again, find where column between 1 and 10, then it actually has to do a scan through the index, the whole index, to find those values. There are issues with collisions happening as well, but the algorithms are designed to essentially reduce that chance that you'll get collisions there. What engines support hash? Memory supports hash. NDB cluster supports it. And as I mentioned, InnoDB has its own internal hash type index as well. If you want to use these quite often, you either have to specify them directly when you create them, or sometimes the engine itself will default to these. So depending on what engine you use, it may default to a B-tree and you have to specify explicitly a hash, or it'll default to a hash and you have to explicitly specify a B-tree. So just be aware of that. To specify what type of index, you just prefix and specify using B-tree or using hash for those. Does anyone actually use hash indexes here? Yep. Classic example of using a hash index is with the memory engine. If you're doing something like a lot of lookups, then you may copy your data into a memory table and have a hash index on it so you can do the equality searches much faster where you're not doing range searches. So, for example, telephone book, where you're looking up an exact number or exact name, it could work quite well with something like that. We have full text indexing for MySQL. It uses the match against syntax. It allows you to index across multiple columns as well, similar to a composite index. But we have different methods of searching within the index. It's not just a straight word type comparison. We can use Boolean searches with the plus and minus syntax, similar to how Google and other search engines have it. We can use phrase searches, and there's other advantages that you can tweak with it to get it to do other things there as well. At the moment, MyISAM, I believe, is the only one that has full text indexing supported. There's talk about others supporting it, but it's not actually there yet. So the example here, we'll have a query where match title abstract against a Boolean, which basically allows us to use that syntax, plus wizard minus Harry minus Potter. So that will find all records where the title and abstract has the word wizard without Harry and without Potter in those as well. We can create that again simply specifying that we want a full text index. And the way the full text index works is it essentially keeps lists of all the words. So it has a keyword search through there. Some of the other ones that you may not be familiar with, R-tree index. Anyone use MySQL for GIS at all? Yep. Well, the MyISAM engine has R-tree support. Essentially, what it allows you to do is take a structure like this, geographically dispersed items, and arrange them into a tree structure based on bounding localities. So we can see here the dotted or dashed lines represent the different bounding rectangles around our regions. Some of them will overlap. There are variations of this where you get them not overlapping and so on. But in our case, we do have overlapping. And it creates a tree structure from that, which we then use in a similar way to your standard B-tree type traversals. So the R-tree is used for spatial indexes. It's not quite true that only MyISAM supports spatial indexes. Other engines can support spatial indexing, but they don't use the R-tree. Only MyISAM uses the R-tree. The others will actually use a B-tree, they just won't tell you. So if you specify a spatial index for other engines, it will default to B-tree. The R3 uses quadratic splitting and the maximum bounding rectangle to construct that spatial index. It has changed recently, however, where you can use other primitives, such as ellipses and so on, to give you a much closer accuracy in that bounding. But I haven't had a chance to try out those features yet. It's useful because it allows fast searches if we're doing things like, is this point located within a particular area? Or I have this particular location, what are the closest areas around it? So good for things if you're doing stuff like postal codes, zip codes, that sort of thing. Very handy there. T-tree index, this is one that's used in MySQL cluster. It's designed to be efficiently use efficiently the memory that is available. So cluster originally was designed to be memory only, so it had both index and data in memory, and that's what the T-tree is designed to optimize. And the way it works, it has pointers to the parent, it has pointers to left and right child, and it has this array within each T-tree, which essentially has a set number of values that you can have in that array, which allows the data to be stored with the index there as well. It's used in MySQL cluster, but other database systems use it as well. Oracle times 10 uses it, for example. It uses efficient memory resources, and currently in MySQL, NDB cluster is still the only one that uses that. For some of the more advanced things, however, there are other options we have. So Lucene search engine, anyone used that? Quite a few using that. It's a Java-flavored search engine API, although you can get variations for pretty much any language that you want now. It's very feature-rich. It does allow live indexing, which is useful, because with some of the indexes, you have to be careful. The larger your data table, the longer it can take to index. So if you do things like bulk loads, having an index can be quite slowing in that sense. It stores values in many different ways to allow us to use those. So we can have stored versus tokenized or indexed or vector based. So all these allow for extra features. So we can get things like, okay, find a word, find these two words that are only two words apart, for example, which is the syntax we've got there. A more recent one is Sphinx search engine. Anyone using that? Anyone heard of that? A couple have heard. No one's using it. It's very high-speed indexing. It's very good for search as well. The search speed is quite phenomenal compared to other ones out there. The average query, when I last checked, was under 0.1, and that was on 2 to 4 gig of text that they had done that on. But it's quite fast. It supports MySQL natively. It actually supports PostgreSQL as well. By default, it's actually outside the database, so it's a separate engine that you can access. But it does have a storage engine option as well, so you can compile in the option to have a Sphinx storage engine, which you join against when you do your query, and that returns the record set with extra statistics to tell you how many documents were found and that sort of thing.
How much overhead is there for
Comparatively, it's quite interesting. There are some features, like, for example, on a lot of data sets, they've found that using Sphinx to do searches on large data sets is actually faster to do that than using an order by in your query within MySQL itself. So it's really fast. but there's a lot of features in this, and there's a lot of stuff still coming into it as well. it's certainly the fastest thing I've seen. I haven't come across anything where it hasn't been slower, where it hasn't been faster than anything else out there. That's not to say that there may be a situation where there is a problem. I haven't tested it with GIS stuff. There is support apparently for GIS stuff in it now. So the geodistance option. So you can actually order things essentially in order of distance between each other and that sort of thing.
What's the license?
It's open source for this one. So, yeah. Yeah, I'm sure it's cheap. It could even be LGPL. Yeah.
I guess it's worth mentioning too that the way, because of the interesting way Sphinx works indexing your tables, you need to have an integer ID.
Yes, that's true.
Which is a problem for those of us that are using GUIDs as a primary key.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. There are some situations where this just won't work. That's one of them. You have to have integer IDs there. Other things, obviously, it supports English and Russian stemming. It supports Russian because the author's Russian. But other more complex languages like Hebrew and Asian and that, it's a bit harder. They are working on doing that using different algorithms, and that's coming along quite well, but depending on what you want to do, it may not suit. Another good feature with Sphinx, it is distributed. So similar to your MKHD type scenario where if you've just got a bit of space somewhere, you can throw it on. Sphinx is the same, so you can actually set it up on all your web servers or multiple database servers and have distributed indexing that way. It supports full text fields, supports a lot of the other stuff that you generally use. And like I said, in certain situations, it's actually faster to use Sphinx to do things like order by than it is within MySQL. So a lot of benefit there. If you're working with a lot of text-based searches with very large data sets, I would highly recommend that you have a look at this. So if you've got things like archiving or stuff like that, it's well worth looking at.
There's a drawback we found with Sphinx versus Lucene. We had a mixed problem Sphinx to Lucene. If you're trying to do really interesting searches on your data set, then Sphinx has a lot of limitations in being able to say plus this and minus this and whether that'll give you a relevance-based search rather than an order-based search. So if you need to do some trickier stuff, Lucene will usually give you
For sure. Sphinx is designed, in a sense, you could think of it as Sphinx is designed to have the person sit down and work out all the types of searches that they want. So if you have a set type of search that you're always using, it works out very well. But if you want a lot more flexibility or want to do an extra option here or there, it's not really well designed for that. You've got to sort of go back in, change settings and reconstruct indexes and so on. So the two situations, that's why I've mentioned both. They serve different purposes, but again, like I said, depending on what you want, have a look at the two, but Sphinx is certainly the faster on a base-by-base comparison. Just quickly, a couple of things talk about. Index merge appeared in 5.0. Which allows you to combine a number of indexes when using the query. And that basically allows us to now do things like this query where we have key 1 equals 10 or key 2 equals 20. It can actually use both those indexes and work out the subset from that. There are still some shortcomings, however, things like range scans. So if we add on to the end of this query and key 3 less than 30, it basically says that will be the default. We'll just ignore the rest. So range scans take precedence in that sense. But this is useful if you're used to writing a lot of your queries optimized by unions, where you have multiple queries and doing a union between them. If you're still doing that, you want to look at index merge with 5.0. Bitmap indexes. This is something that's not available yet, but everyone's waiting for, particularly if you're doing large data set stuff. Anyone doing data warehousing or very large data sets? A few people. Bitmap indexing will help out a lot there. Essentially, they're much smaller in comparison to standard types, and they allow for a very easy combination of result sets. So you can just do simple and or exclusive or type combinations to allow easier filtering for our result sets. And that way we can do aggregation on a smaller result set than rather on 100 million records. So what's summarising, just what are some of the good indexing etiquette that we can look at? First off, keep them as small as possible. Look at using things like int or date or something small rather than varchar 50 for your primary key. That's particularly important with NODB. Prefix long text fields for indexing. So depending on your storage engine, you may be able to do that. You can prefix the index to only use the first 10 characters or 5 characters or whatever. Use composite indexes. They're usually better. Covering indexes are better still. And choose the appropriate method. So depending on what sort of data and operations you're using, choose the engine and index that works for that. So, any questions? Yep. I don't know of any figures offhand, no. You know?
Depending on engine, as in like yeah. Hash indexes.
Yeah, if we wanted to implement hash indexing in my ISAM, how much extra would it add to it?
It really depends on implementation. I mean, on cluster, yeah. That's basically the only index in the mail orders, but the primary index is in there, all hash indexes, and we just use hash buckets.
Yeah. Actually, the bitmap indexing, they do that way too. You can actually do it via buckets to group them together.
So usually yeah. Bitmap can be like sparse bitmap indexes and stuff. So when you have lots and lots of sort of yes or no, so you can like press that up and be sure that it's efficient. So again, it all depends on the engine. I mean, there is no sort of common indexing code in MySQL at all. Each engine does it its own way. So when you talk about sort of like hash indexes or bitmap indexes, it really depends on which engine is implemented and how they're done. So, you know, the heap as an in-memory engine will do it differently than my ISAM engine, just because of memory, will do it different than cluster, because we do it across cluster.
Thank you.
Pretty good.
Yep.
That assumes that you're doing all of the actual distances and stuff inside the database, right?
Yeah, what the R-tree allows you to do is, within MySQL, the GIS, you have a lot of GIS-related functions as well. And you'll see those, a lot of them will have MBR as part of the function. And that basically allows you to use the spatial data type, so point, polygon, line, and so on, and use those with the R-tree to, like I said, do things like locate nearest value or is value within area and so on. So,
and that's in 5?
Well, the GIS stuff has been around since 4.1, actually, but 5 was probably the best support for it so far.
5.1 is where any engine can store GIS stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah. So 5.1, any engine can store GIS data. It's just indexing. And so in 5.1 it's implemented as a blob. So the engine supports blobs that can go in there. So it's up to the engine putting this stuff in. It's 5.1.
Yeah, but if you want to use the advantage of the R-tree, you'd have to use my ISAM at this point. Because the others do it through a B-tree.
If you really need to do heavy-duty GIS stuff, you
Yeah.
That's what I was trying to use the
first. Yeah. If you're doing a heavily GI.
It's very complete in what it does, and people who work on that have basically taken what they didn't like in Oracle and other places and have built exactly what they need. So it doesn't implement everything, but it implements everything that some real users need, and it's light years ahead of whatever MySQL has at the moment. So there's just no contest at all.
Yeah, it's just because they've got one data base, which is PostgreSQL, which actually does the GIS, and the other one is MySQL. So.
Yeah,
but
that's a good solution. Yeah, sure.
The main use I've seen for GIS.
when in doubt, turn it on.
Jonathan, goodness, what have you done to me? Okay. I like to walk around, so this is better not done. So how many of you have used another database or do frequently use other database servers? Okay, that's a couple. Oracle? Yep, handful of Oracles. Postgres? Yep. SQL Server, Microsoft? Yeah. Well, don't be too positive. okay, any others?
SQLite.
Okay, yep. Well, not quite client server, but yeah, fair enough. Oh, we're good friends. We're good friends with the guy who designed that, Richard Hipp. He's an excellent fella. Yep. Any others? No? Okay. Well, that's
using
not quite. Okay. So then you have a bit of idea there. Of course, one of the key things that distinguishes MySQL from other database servers is that it actually has multiple storage engines. And I've got a 5.1 beta around here. And yeah, we'll look at this later. But if we do that, it's a bit messy in terms of output. I might make it a bit smaller. No, well, I'll make it smaller there, increase it there again. Give me a moment. Okay. I haven't actually compiled many of them in. So this is a build that I've done on my laptop. This is actually Core 2 Duo, so it's a 64-bit Mac. There's no binaries from MySQL for that, so I built my own. Plus, I'm building my own storage engine, so I was actually trying to muck around a bit. The server, in essence, is unmodified. I've just built a 64-bit Mac version. So that's where we're at. And it's a 5.1.23 release candidate debug version, so it's, I don't know, a couple of months old from a source tree. What I've built in is the Archive engine, which is a pretty interesting piece of work. Archive compresses rows while you write them, and then it only supports selects, so it only supports insert and selects. You can't delete or update because the compressed stream is not modifiable. So it basically writes a gzip output of your well, kind of like in MyISAM structure. It's fairly similar, I would think. But
we also have active feature requests. Never add, update, or delete.
Oh, well, fair and fine. Yeah. Yes. Well, that's the thing. You don't want update or delete because if you actually use it for auditing, then you don't want it to be allowed. Well, there's ways around that, but in any case. So anyone have an idea why you might want to write it as a compressed data stream? What do you actually gain here? Yeah, space. But most people don't really have a space problem, but you could have. Exactly. Disk I.O. is one of the slowest bits in your environment. It's nicer to do things in memory. You probably have enough CPU power. You can have multi-cores and so on, but at some point you have your disk bottleneck. So reducing your disk I.O. is actually a good thing. CSV can actually operate on CSV files, comma-separated files, directly. You would generally only use that for imports and exports. Now, there's a very nifty trick there. If you only write to them from inside the MySQL server, as in doing search, and you can update, do updates and deletes on those, you can actually read externally without breaking anything. If you write to them, as in append to that file externally, you can read from it internally without breaking anything. That's quite nice. You don't have to do any fancy locking and semaphoring and so on. But you could also just copy in a file, and MySQL will find that file as long as it has a proper table structure for it, and it can read it directly. So it's a fast way of importing data or exporting data. That works quite well. And then, of course, there's MyISAM memory, which Jonathan already covered. I'll quickly show you something. And then cover a couple of things of why this is the way it is. Little bit of a quiz, and those of you who have seen this gizmo, you're excluded from the quiz, obviously. How fast, yes, you and Giuseppe, how fast do you reckon MySQL can actually insert? I've given you the specs. It's a 2.2 gigahertz Core 2 Duo, so it's a 64-bit Running Mac OS X, which is a desktop operating system, so you can't actually max out the CPUs. It refuses to do that, and the disk file system sucks, as Stuart will be happy to explain to you in great detail. Buy him a beer and he'll explain all about it. And after that, you need to drink that bottle of water over it. So that's the specs. How many rows per second do you think I can insert on a single connection to MySQL? And I'll give you the hint. I'm using the MyISAM storage engine because it turns out being the fastest for this purpose. I can use any engine, but how many rows a second? Just insert. 60 byte rows. So data acquisition style things. So that could be from, I don't know, I might be collecting IP addresses from a router, from traffic, or I might be collecting web clicks from a website, from Apache, things like that. Data acquisition. How many rows a second might I be able to insert into this MySQL instance on my laptop?
10,000.
10,000 a second? Okay, yep. Anyone else?
Indexes and stuff?
No indexes, nope. Because in the end, when I'm going to analyze it, I'm going to have to scan the entire table anyway. So the index is not going to do me any good, unless I'm going to have to find a specific item. If I'm doing data acquisition, I wouldn't be running the select queries on the same system. I would run it off a slave. So the slave might have an index, and the master might not. So that, again, that's an optimization trick. If you have a master-slave configuration, which is very good for things like data warehousing, the master wouldn't actually have any indexing because it slows down the inserts. You don't want that. And nasty selects shouldn't actually destroy your master. That's why you run them on the slave. So, good question. No indexes. Okay, 10,000. Anyone else? Higher, lower?
How much RAM do you like?
4 gig. I don't use it.
Probably higher than 10,000.
Probably high. Okay, yeah, fair enough. The price could be right, yeah? Okay, well, let's have a look. Anybody can read it? Yeah, about. Yeah. It actually gets up to 320 if I run it on a proper 64-bit Linux box. That's my current limit. There's some aspects to this gizmo that don't quite make it as fast as it can be, which means I could get higher. So, your 10,000, we can do slightly better than that. Yeah, fair enough. Well, like I said, desktop operating system, it's doing other stuff, so.
Some other process on OS X decided to like do
IO. Now, here's the interesting thing. Here's the really interesting thing. While I was playing with this on a Linux box, and again, like I said, I can't test this on the Mac because the Mac, I can't max out the CPUs. You can tell at the top there, those two things, those are my two CPUs. They're not actually that loaded, so I'm probably maxing out my disk IO at the moment. I don't know. There's profiling trickery inside. This is running Leopard. I can probably find out. What I found out mostly is that I can't max out anything because I think per process, the Mac OS X just reduces my load a little bit so other applications will still work and be responsive, stuff like that. If I run this on Linux, I can max stuff out. What am I maxing out? What do you reckon? You'd think so, which is why the archive storage engine exists, right? Because it's reducing the disk IO. Wrong. I actually max out the CPUs, which I found very interesting. Again, this is my ISAM. So that's a very interesting lesson. I max out the CPUs, and my disk IO is still okay, which means that if I start a second thread to the MySQL server, I could actually write even more. Two different table would be the best way, because then the two wouldn't actually interfere with each other. But even if it were the same table, I might still be able to raise it slightly. I've tried that, and I can raise it a little bit. It doesn't quite double, because at some point, the concurrency on the one table, of course, becomes a problem. On different tables, I should be able to get much higher again. So you create a kind of like a user land partitioning to do that. Anyway, just to give you an idea, what am I actually doing here? How am I inserting here? What magic trickery am I using that allows me to actually get this fast? It's a C client, because doing this in PHP or Java or whatever would just not be fast enough. it's an unmodified server. I just compiled it myself. But I've done it on stock systems as well. And it's an unmodified MySQL client library, C library, that I've linked into my C client. So that's the basic environment. What am I doing to actually make it this fast? And it is dropping a bit, eh? What's that? Yes, how am I buffering the insert? You just walk in, dude. Give it time. Yeah? No, how am I buffering them? What am I doing?
Oh, I assume that I don't know how.
Okay, well, I'll show you the table structure. So that's the table structure. It's just a one character field, 60 bytes long. It doesn't really matter even if there were a couple of other fields in there. That doesn't significantly change the performance. If I change the row length, originally I had 80 bytes, it doesn't affect performance at all, which again proves that I'm not maxing out the disk. So writing a bit more didn't actually slow me down. Interesting. I learned some very interesting lessons there. Just apparently I'm not maxing it out. So I had a little discussion with Brian Aker. Okay, so why does the archive engine exist? What are we trying to save here? Well, it still has some purposes, but it wasn't what we originally thought. I think I've just introduced a buzz by kicking a cable. Still have it? It's gone now. Okay. I'm using what's called a multi-row insert, which is actually standard SQL. Who here uses a multi-row insert? Yeah, all those MySQL. My colleagues and extra ex-colleagues. No one else. That's a bit disturbing. I'll write it on the board. Okay. Fair enough. Yes, but you are a bit of an exclusive example.
IBM DB2 supports it.
It does now. Wow.
It does?
Well, it does. Well, this is English grammar, but yes. That's cool. So, insert into table, and then you get values. I should stop. I've run this for how many minutes? Oh, 317 seconds. Okay, so that's 5 minutes, 40 million rows. You can do the math yourself and see that I'm not faking it. We can now go to the client and select count star from lossy log. There you go, 40 million. Now, running queries on this, of course, gets a bit painful, particularly since it's unindexed. It's also just nonsense. Limit 3. Yeah, that's what I'm writing with the sequence number in front of the string, just to give you an idea of what I'm sticking in. So I am writing different strings, not the same string. And the rest is just a counter, so I have my number of bytes in there. The only way to actually get rid of this table easily, truncate table lossy log, which is reasonably fast on my iPhone since it just wipes the thing. The reason it's slow now is because the OS X file system sucks. Four and a half seconds. If you try to do this on other storage engines, they don't actually do truncate directly. They actually delete all the rows from the table. InnoDB can truncate properly. Others just delete all the rows from the table. This will take a long time. I tried this on an earlier version of Falcon. Not happy. It actually crashed Falcon at the time. But that was a very early preview release of Falcon, so I can forgive it for that. But it wasn't a fast operation. So for doing testing, I just use my iSum. It's by far the fastest. I should do that. Alter table, lossy log, engine equals. Well, this is really interesting because by using black hole, we can actually cut out the disk IO factor.
Yes.
And see how fast it really is. So there is, of course, overhead in the disk IO.
Wow.
So if you do this on a 64-bit multi-core regular desktop Linux box with a decent file system, it's still X3 actually, then you get 400 something thousand. I haven't tried it on XFS yet, which should be faster than X3, I think. Stuart, no, yes?
Yeah.
Just on plain writes on this kind of nonsense?
Yeah, I guess so.
Possibly. Anyway, it's a little bit faster. but not significantly compared to what your normal applications do compared to what this does. So, interesting. So now I could keep it running because it doesn't fill any disk space. A black hole is a special engine. It doesn't actually write anything. Has anyone here used black hole?
Yes.
Okay. Who here thinks black hole is a joke? That would be a valid answer too. Black hole, it doesn't store any raw data, but it is useful because if you switch on binary logging, it does log what you do. So the inserts get logged, which means they can get replicated. So you can have it on a backup, and you can have it on a replication system. And on a replicated slave, you could have a different engine, MyISAM, InnoDB, cluster, whatever. So you can have the data and actually query it there. So it is not a joke. It can also be used in a replication infrastructure as a kind of filter in between a master and a slave, an extra system that actually filters out some tables and data and that kind of stuff. So there are actually some practical uses for black hole. It is not a joke. Anyway, back to the multi-row insert before we had that that little bit of fun back there. So you have your regular insert statement, and then here is your row with the various columns in there. And then at the end, closing parentheses, comma, and then the second row. And you can actually repeat that. One of the ways that, I call it Lossy Logger, but the inserter component of Lossy Logger does, it combines those rows that I'm inserting into a very big insert statement. It's several hundred thousand. Yes? What time? Nearly done? Yes, I will be. Okay. A couple of very quick other ideas. Who here uses things like this? Okay, what do you think this does? Really? Okay, so how many bytes does this take? Hmm? 4 bytes? Okay. How much does that take? How much space? Yeah. The 410 actually is output formatting. It has nothing to do with the storage. An int is always 4 bytes. But there are other integer types. And MySQL has more integer types than most, and please make use of it. There's something called a small int, which uses 2 bytes. There's a big int, which uses 8 bytes. This really significantly changes the way, disk I/O, storage, in-memory use, the speed at which an index can be scanned, because if you index this, of course, you can have more of these items in an index page, so you can actually scan it faster. And find things faster. That's actually quite a nice thing. If you do joins on it, of course, that becomes more efficient as well. It's things like that that you need to think about when actually building your application. I'll give you one other one, because it was just a quick overview, just a couple of little ideas, and then we'll go on to the next talk, I believe. Is the next talk, or is it lunch, or what are we doing? 11:20. Oh, okay, that's fine. I'll just 1 minute. Okay, let's assume you have an index. Is this useful? Yeah? You reckon? Okay, because? Yes. Yes, except they're generally not used for order bytes, but yeah. If you're searching on A, just A, that index can be used. If you're searching on A and B, that index can be used. So if you're searching on A and B, it can pick either. That's fine. Generally speaking, you can probably cut that one out. Because if you're using both, it depends a bit on what happens in the rest of the query. If you happen to do a select on A and B, and then you do a group by on A, then it actually makes sense to have that one, or an order by on A. Anyway, superfluous indexes. Having an index just on A makes no sense at all. Look at schemas that come from like generic applications, things like WordPress and I don't think Drupal has any such nasties. Horde had it in the past, they duplicate lots of indexes. They have like a primary key on a certain value, and then a secondary index that actually indexes the same exact same column. It's harmless, but it slows down in search because you have a duplicate key. You just a duplicate index. It just doesn't help in any particular way. Someone mentioned GUIDs earlier, so globally unique IDs. So that's a long string that is globally unique, which you may want to use as a primary key. Now, this works okay for instance, MyISAM, which actually doesn't care about what its primary key is in particular. That may just be whatever you want it to be. However, if you were to do joins from that table onto something else, you don't want to actually join on a GUID, because that means you have the GUID in the other table as well. It's just a very long string. So it's inefficient in terms of joins because it needs to do a long comparison, shuffle around more data. If you're doing joins, do it on a primary key that is relatively short. It would be an int or big int. It's either 4 bytes or 8 bytes. There's another reason. If you're using the InnoDB engine, it actually always uses a primary key because its data is actually stored right next to its primary key in the same blocks. Secondary indexes in InnoDB contain the value. So this is let's say I call it B, an ID. This is what a secondary index looks like. Yeah? If you have an index on B, it'll point back to your ID. Now, if your ID is a GUID, you've got that long string here in your secondary index, and then it needs to look up that index in the primary key. Hideously inefficient. And that's why you don't want to use GUIDs as your primary key. It is fine to use GUIDs as a unique key, just don't make it the primary one.
You got into GUIDs in the first place because you've got replication. You get something unique when you do inserts in different...
Ah, yes, for multiple masters. Multi-master system. MySQL 5 can do it without. MySQL 5, you can actually teach that that different servers actually keep a different offset and spacing. It's called auto-increment increment and auto-increment offset. Show variables like... Those are the two. Auto-increment increment, auto-increment offset. One you would set to like the number of servers, and the other one you would just give 0, 1, 2, 3, and they keep it. So it spaces out, but you should have enough range anyway. A big int doesn't run out of numbers for a couple of million years, even if you insert thousands of rows a second. So should be fine. So that's one way to get around it. There are more ways. The thing with InnoDB is another interesting thing. So a secondary index always contains the primary key, which means that you never, as a secondary index, need to have an index on that. It's superfluous, because if you know it's InnoDB, you could just use that. Isn't that nice? Because you get the other one implicitly. If you specify this, what you actually get is that. Hey, isn't that cool? Anyway, there's so many of those little tricks that you just want to know about. It could actually, yeah. I actually didn't find this until a couple of months ago. Where is this hiding? There. A couple of people actually, can you still read that? Window, not Zoom, full screen. Can we do that? There we go. It mangled it a bit. Okay, who here has this book? The original version, that is, first edition. So the original version of this book was written by Jeremy Zawodny and Dirk Bolling. Jeremy Zawodny works at Yahoo. The guy who actually found this thing with InnoDB is Baron Schwartz, a valued community member. Anyway, a whole group of people, Vadim, Peter, and I, being my ex-MySQL employees, so one community person and the original authors, have been working on the second edition of this book, High Performance MySQL. And it's something that just came up along the way. It's kind of obvious when you think about it with hindsight, but no one ever realized. Just one of those things. So it's kind of an undocumented feature, and I don't think Hecky, the guy who wrote the InnoDB engine, actually thought about it at the time. It could probably be optimized away. But doing that kind of stuff automatically tends to get MySQL in trouble because anytime MySQL makes assumptions like that, someone will complain about it doing stuff under the hood that it shouldn't be doing. So now you know that, yeah, exactly. You don't want to do things without knowing about it. So now you know. Anyway, so this was just a quick overview of what you might want to be looking at. There's so many, many, many more. The key lesson being what I've just talked about, they're all little MySQL tricks. All of those combined make for faster MySQL applications by a factor of many, as you've seen by my inserter. I've used multi-row inserts and I've done some other tweaking of server parameters. I haven't modified the server and you get hundreds of thousands of rows a second as opposed to, I don't know, if you run this through just a regular Java thing or I can actually show you. If you just do one row at a time, MySQL insert one. There you go. Yeah, it's several thousand. It's still not slow. There's still some parameters that could tweak and stuff. But this is, well, what you have to realize also that this is on black hole. So let me tweak it back to my ISAM. Okay, slightly lower. It's not too bad. My ISAM is actually extremely fast at inserts. And it's also pretty good at selects. And one of the really cool things about my ISAM is it can run inserts and selects at the same time. The inserts have to come from a single thread, though. So this is really interesting. They don't lock each other out. It is not just fast for selects. It's fast for selects and a single insert thread. And you can really use that to your advantage in this particular case, so for data warehousing. So there's lots of information online that always said, oh, MySQL is fast for, or my ISAM is fast for inserts, and otherwise it sucks. Wrong, they just haven't read the rest of the paragraph in the manual, or haven't been to one of my training courses. So this is what you could do. This is the speed you can reach if just using single row inserts. And you can tell the difference. There's a serious, serious difference. So I hope you found this useful. Feel free to ask me for questions later in other breaks. Yes, sure.
For the Linux one, whereby you ran on the Linux server,
yes. How many seconds? I think I got to about 320 in the last test that I did, and that was a quad core that I'm not actually using. I'm running it on the same system, so I'm using one core to do this tool and one core for the server, essentially running that thread. And I've tested it with other storage engines, and they're just much slower. I think InnoDB got to about 120,000 or something. Falcon, when it was actually running, like I said, it was an early version and it crashed on me, but it was about 80,000-90,000. I was quite impressed with InnoDB, but it's a factor of three slower than my ISAM. So for this kind of data acquisition stuff, you don't need your transaction. The reason I call it lossy logger, there's a couple of extra components that I'm working on. It actually doesn't mind losing a couple of rows. It doesn't lose it in this component. Yeah, this sounds weird, doesn't it? I don't mind losing a couple of rows, and I'll tell you why. If you're tracking web clicks, you use that for statistics at the end of the month. Even if you lose thousands of those clicks over that month, it doesn't change your graph at the end of the month. It's statistically insignificant. You can use, I don't know, you can lose 2 or 3% without blinking. So what does that actually do? Allowing you to actually lose a couple of rows on insert. Again, this is a very specific purpose. I'm fully aware that quite often when you're storing data, you want to keep that data, right? But in this case, I started playing with UDP. What advantage does UDP have? I don't actually need to make a connection. So rather than TCP, where I need to make a connection to this tool to do the insert from various locations, I just toss a UDP packet at it from 100 different Apache servers, for instance. Works quite well. Every once in a while, you get a buffer overflow, so you lose a couple of packets. Tough luck. It doesn't matter. Very specific purpose, but it worked quite well.